welcome to the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast, discussing and analyzing the legal implications of national security issues across the globe. Our hosts, Hogan Lovells attorneys Michael Scheimer and Tim Bergreen, have decades of hands-on experience in national security issues and how they relate to their clients' day-to-day goals. And now, here are Michael and Tim.
Hi, I'm Mike Scheimer.
I'm Tim Bergreen, and you're joining the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great, Tim. Today, we're joined by Lisa Ellman, head of our global UAS practice.
The famous Lisa Ellman. In fact, she's globally famous now because it's my understanding that the Financial Times, the pink newspaper that some of us still receive, named her the most innovative lawyer for 2022 for North America. So congratulations, Lisa, and we're really looking forward to having you join us today and for the discussion.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thanks, Mike, for having me. I'm really excited about this. Great to be here with you guys.
So what is the Financial Times Most Innovative Lawyer 2022 North America?
Well, I was really, really excited about that. That was a huge honor. It happened last week, actually, at an event in New York. And, you know, from my perspective, it was a recognition of the incredible work that all of our clients are doing in innovation. And the fact that I get to be a partner alongside all of our amazing clients as they seek to integrate the airspace, move aviation forward, advance aviation. You know, my practice focuses on not just commercial drones, but also advanced air mobility, drone security, anything kind of that flies and advancing aviation. And so, you know, I was really, really honored with that award and grateful to our incredible clients who are doing amazing things and, you know, just trying to move UAS and AAM integration forward safely and securely.
So Lisa, you're sort of known as a pathbreaker in the UAS space. And in fact, when I was in the process of joining Hogan Lovells, a lot of people mentioned you and your practice as being particularly innovative. And I was wondering, what drew you to start focusing on unmanned aerial systems or drones?
Sure. So my focus was, you know, I come from the federal government side, Tim, as you do as well. And I know, Mike, you had a stint in the federal government as well. You know, my background, I worked both at the White House and at the Department of Justice. And my focus really was over several years working under President Barack Obama was integrating emerging technologies and focusing on bringing policy and innovation together, even back dating back to my time on the Obama campaign. In 2012, the federal government, you know, given all of the many benefits of what used to be considered toys, are now tools of public agencies and industry, given all the benefits of drones, the federal government was mandated to integrate drones into our national airspace. And so I was asked at that point to help run a working group at the Department of Justice that would seek to integrate drones safely, securely, respective of privacy, while also helping to lead some of the White House's efforts, integration just broadly with all of the federal agencies as part of the interagency group. So I saw from inside government, this was back in 2012, 2013, 2014, what an incredible new industry this was going to be. And the policy issues were intriguing, right? Anytime you're bringing a new technology and integrating them into an existing regulatory environment, you're going to run into challenges. And so I realized I could really help the industry more from the outside, move to the private sector, launched a drones practice, founded the Commercial Drone Alliance, which is an independent 501c6 organization focused on moving the commercial drone industry forward, and have been working on that all day, every day for the last decade.
Can you tell us a little more about the Commercial Drone Alliance and kind of what their mission is? And also, how is that different from sort of, say, coming from the Department of Defense and the drone world to me? You know, for some of us, it means, you know, the Predator and, like, you know, these big manned weapon systems type drones. So what's the Commercial Drone Alliance compared to, say, those are from the defense background?
Sure. So when I think of Commercial Drone Alliance, it's companies in the drone space, but that are focused on the civil use of drones. So everything from, you know, use of drones for commercial industrial purposes, think of package delivery, medical, you know, prescription drug delivery, critical national infrastructure inspection, and everything in between, precision agriculture, you know, filmmaking, news gathering, the possibilities are endless. So the Commercial Drone Alliance brings together all of the industry leaders. We have a board of directors of 14 organizations, mostly companies, but also we have, for example, the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma, who's a leader in this space, the FAA-designated test site NewAir up in New York, who's a leader in this space. So we bring together lots of the leaders and we, you know, advocate on behalf of the commercial drone industry. And companies, as you all know, love drones. They're also worried about rogue drones. So we also focus heavily on drone security issues as something that is of top interest to our members.
Which brings us, I guess, you know, to sort of the beginning of our segue to the next part of our discussion. What legal architecture now regulates the use or flying of drones in the United States, either for personal purposes or for commercial purposes?
Sure. So essentially, the use of drones is regulated by intent. So you mentioned drones for personal purposes. That means that you're a hobbyist for recreational use and you have your own kind of carve out from some of the more regulated drone use. If you're not operating primarily or only for hobbyist use, you would fall into either, you know, public use if you're a public entity, like a public agency, state or local law enforcement, for example, or a civil use, which would include commercial use. Frankly, the rules are somewhat antiquated. And like I said, rules and laws that were designed for manned crewed aviation have been applied incongruously to unmanned, uncrewed aircraft. And that's been a challenge for the industry. Back in 2016, 2017 time period, Part 107 was implemented. Part 107 enables low-risk drone operations broadly. That was a big deal because it was the first time that a rule actually broadly enabled commercial drone use in the United States. Previously, you had to get a case-by-case approval. But since then, we haven't had, you know, and then there's been an operations over people rule, a remote ID rule, a few different rules, but none that have really opened the door yet for what is the holy grail of the commercial drone industry, which is beyond visual line of sight. Being able to operate without having to see the aircraft. Imagine operating an aircraft and not being able to see it leave the airport, or, you know, building a truck and not let it, but you can't operate it beyond like your driveway, right? It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. You can't actually take advantage of the efficiencies and all of the benefits of the technology. And so the Commercial Drone Alliance is working very closely with both Congress. I actually just testified to the Senate Commerce Committee in September as part of the first FAA reauthorization hearing on new entrants, as well as with the White House. We worked closely with the White House as they hosted an AAM summit, Advanced Air Mobility Summit, on August 3rd. As you know, we seek to move the policies forward, both on the safety side as well as on the security side.
Right. And so technologically speaking, are we, you know, is beyond visual line of sight, is that capable today, or is that something that we're still working towards?
The technology is here today. The policies are not. And part of the challenge is that there aren't yet standards, for example, for detect and avoid technology. And so it's been difficult. The FAA, and there's a lot of amazing people at the FAA who are trying really, really hard to do this work. The challenge is trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. And, you know, anytime you want to fly beyond visual line of sight in any way that is beyond that, you know, right now it's been incredibly restrictive. You have to have, for example, a ground-based radar or some, you know, you have lots of like redundancies in terms of the technology. It's site-specific approvals for the most part. And, you know, again, like the challenge has been the regulatory framework does not recognize this technology. Imagine like if, you know, you have like a small 5-pound styrofoam drone that has to abide by the same rules as a 747 in certain circumstances. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? So it leads to these absurd results. And so there are a lot of folks within the federal government that are trying really, you know, hard to move all this forward. There are people on the private sector side, lots of great organizations and great companies that are innovating in the space. But it is a challenge. And frankly, a lot of companies are having to move overseas in order to be able to scale their drone operations. So we're seeing lots of drone operations in Australia, in Europe, and, you know, around the world in Asia, because the regulatory frameworks are more amenable. And that, I believe, is a national security challenge for the United States, because a lot of this civil technology can also be used by the military. It might not be designed for the military, but we're seeing, for example, drones used in Ukraine for various reasons. So from a national security standpoint, it's critical that we maintain our U.S. global leadership in advanced aviation so that we're not losing it to other countries. And in order to do that, we need to move these rules forward.
So I guess there's sort of two sets of rules. One is there's sort of the enabling kinds of rules. And I would assume that those are addressed sort of in FAA reauthorization and in rulemaking by the FAA. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes. So we see innovation and security as two sides of the same coin. So the enabling regulations certainly is focused on FAA rules. But the national security agencies have also been very active on things like Beyond Visual Line of Sight. And, you know, it is important to have a whole of agency, a whole of government approach to drone integration, because there are a lot of other agencies as well with equities, but certainly the FAA is the safety entity, regulatory authority.
And so how does the Preventing Emerging Threats Act of 2018 fit into this sort of regulatory, you know, architecture?
So the Preventing Emerging Threats Act was actually passed as part of FAA reauthorization in 2018. So, you know, that was obviously on the security side, but just as a bit of background, I mentioned Part 107, which went into effect 2016, 2017 time period. Once that was done, the FAA was actually ready to start moving what's known as expanded operations forward. Operations over people, operations beyond visual line of sight, operations at night. And the national security agencies at that point stood up and said, wait, we need, in order to, you know, while we appreciate the good side of drones and what all that drones offer, we're also worried about the bad. And before we approve expanding operations, we believe there need to be some security protocols in place. And those security protocols were two. The first, the ability to identify friend versus foe. So I be able to look outside and know, is that a good drone or is that, is that a careless, clueless or a criminal drone? Is that a malicious or, you know, like knowing whether that drone is a friendly or not. And then second, if the answer is no, if it is a criminal drone, for example, or a drone used by a criminal, then having the mitigation authority, having the authority to be able to mitigate that threat. Because drones, like I said, are treated like aircraft under the law, that also means that leads to kind of absurd results under Title 18 or Title 49, for example, with the criminal code. You know, if you shoot down a drone, you're actually shooting down an aircraft, and that is clearly a crime, right? That's against the law. Same with if you hack into a drone, you're violating Title 18. If you are taking over a drone, like some of these counter drone technologies do, you are violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, potentially, right? So there's all kinds of laws that were not designed for counter drone technology, the different technologies that are able to mitigate rogue drones, but that would apply potentially. And that the interagency has been very clear what apply they consider to apply. And so, you know, the Penn Register Trap and Trace Act is another example that was designed for landline telephones, but they would interpret it to potentially apply to counter drone technology. So in order to give national security agencies, DHS and DOJ, the authority to shoot down the drone or hack into a drone or potentially mitigate a drone threat where there is a threat, the Preventing Emerging Threats Act provided waivers to Title 18 in a very narrow set of circumstances with heavy privacy and transparency protocols in place. And that went into effect in 2018, and it actually was up for expiration. I believe it was October 6th or so, early October. And so this year, there's been a big debate over extending the timeline for it and actually expanding the authorities that are there.
And what's the state of that debate at the moment? Because I know there's been action by the administration, extensive action by the administration. There's been hearings on the Hill. There's been legislation, at least in the Senate. Can you talk a little bit about where we are?
Sure. So the administration came out with its own national action plan on counter drone. And that was a really important step forward. It was a generally very, very comprehensive, excellent document. There's obviously certain things that can't be done through executive action that legislation is necessary for. So it provided draft legislation to the Hill, which most importantly would create a counter drone pilot program. So we talked about the Preventing Emerging Threats Act, and DOD and also Department of Energy have limited authorities to use counter drone technology, but only those four federal agencies. That's it right now. And so if you're a state or locality, for example, like state or local law enforcement, that's like protecting a stadium, or, you know, you don't have the authority to use counter-drone. The only agencies that have the authority, or if you're a private entity protecting your nuclear facility or critical national infrastructure, you don't have the authority to use counter-drone technology. And so what this legislation would do, which was proposed to the Hill, would create a counter-drone pilot program, which would enable state and local law enforcement 12 per year to get approved to do essentially a pilot program with the federal government, with strong and heavy oversight from the federal government on training and legal frameworks, that kind of thing, for the use of counter-drone technology. It would also broadly enable detection technology, which is, it seems to be, you know, kind of a no-brainer, especially in the era of remote ID, where it would make sure that there's no gray areas around the use of detection technology for critical national infrastructure owners and operators. The National Action Plan also did some other things, but those were kind of the most important pieces of it, and that got the most support from the community. And from there, Senator Peters put forward, basically took the administration's proposal and proposed it as part of his legislation. And that got pretty broad support in the Senate, but not in the House. On the House side, there emerged some concerns about the use of counter-drone technology, transparency concerns, or civil liberties and privacy concerns. And there has emerged kind of a big debate over, for example, you know, the concern would be the use of counter-drone technology for bad. So we all recognize that there's this threat and that we need to enable the use of counter-drone technology in certain situations. The question is like the edge cases where local law enforcement should not be able to use counter-drone technology to shoot down a drone that is covering protests, that is like a news gathering drone covering protests against that local law enforcement, right? And so building in some of those guardrails on the House side, House Judiciary Committee pushback. And so we now, they have their own proposal. So we now have two conflicting proposals, one on the House side, one on the Senate side. And at this point, it looks like we might just see either a clean extension or cutting back on the existing Preventing Emerging Threats Act. It's unclear at this point where it's going to go. And you would know, you know, I guess you've been probably following the Omni and whether that's going to happen and get pushed to February. There might be more time to talk about this, but we're now, you know, in the final stages here where we'll learn more about what's coming. But the extension, the counter-drone pilot program, the extension of detection technologies, all that will now be talked about during FAA reauthorization, which is next year. It expires in September of 2023. So security will be a prominent part of FAA reauthorization discussions in addition to security, to safety.
So Lisa, I have a question about sort of the line between detection and mitigation, if there is a line. It sounds like some of the things we've talked about, you know, in the mitigation space, one would think to our, you know, to the casual listener, maybe that seems like a pretty clear line about shoot down the drone, hack the drone, like, you know, kinetic activities to mitigate a drone possibly can have some fallout. But, you know, detection would be, I'm a critical infrastructure operator, right? I've got, you know, my power plant or, you know, or the stadium. You gave a good example with sporting events. So I want to be able to at least detect things in the airspace, but it sounds like there's even possibly some limits on that when you mentioned other federal laws too. So is there even a clear line just in terms of my ability to detect drones, or is that also still part of this problem where the laws are kind of antiquated?
It's a great question, Mike. And this is something that we are often advising our clients on, right? So kind of depends on whether the signal is public and whether it's encrypted, if it's entirely passive versus more active. Frankly, the devil's in the details. So on the detection side, this is what the legislation is trying to clarify, is that it should be legal to use detection technology. It's kind of a chicken or the egg problem, because the Hill wants data to prove that this legislation is necessary, but you're not allowed to use detection technology, or it's unclear if you have the legal authority to use detection technology in order to gather that data. Right. And so it's like the chicken or the egg problem, where you can't gather the data because it may be illegal, but, you know, so it's doesn't really work. So clearly, broadly enabling detection technology is a no-brainer, frankly, for Congress. We just need to make it so that we are able to gather this data, which is critical in order to inform, you know, the legislation. Like we said, you know, and like I said, the Commercial Drone Alliance has been very supportive of the Peters proposal. from the commercial drone community's perspective, innovation and security are two sides of the same coin. You need to, in order to innovate, you need to do it securely. And in order to have security, you have to innovate. So we can't have one without the other. So we recognize that all of this needs to move forward thoughtfully.
So Lisa, I want to get back to sort of some of the broader national security issues. You know, I think we've all watched the way that the Ukrainians have used commercial off-the-shelf drones in their war with Russia. You know, and obviously, if they can do it, bad guys here can do it, whether, you know, they're domestic terrorists or foreign terrorists. And how is that playing into your work with the CDA? How is that playing out on the Hill? You know, how do you see that driving that this process? Because I can actually see it accelerating it in a good way, because people will see the capability and also want to take steps to make it safe. And I could also see, you know, people just trying to shut it all down while, you know, policymakers take a decade or more to sort it out. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think, Tim, what you describe is just another reason that it's a national security issue for the United States to have a strong domestic industrial UAS base. And that's something that I think has been bipartisan and there's general agreement on. The challenge that we have is that it is very difficult as a UAS business to do business in the United States because the regulatory frameworks are so limited. So, you know, therefore, you see other countries like China taking a lead. I mean, the biggest, you know, right now, certainly China has the biggest market share when it comes to small UAS. If policymakers decide to just put it aside here in the US, we will fall even farther behind the rest of the international community. I mean, the reality is this technology has moved forward. It's being used by countries around the world, in countries around the world. And we either want to remain the leader in advanced aviation, or we want to cede it. And I think that we can all agree that it's in our best national interest to maintain our leadership here. So, you know, there are certain programs. There's the Blue Small UAS program, for example, that DOD has that kind of, you know, certifies a drone for use by the federal government that can't use Chinese technology. I think the real crux of this, though, is moving the regulatory frameworks forward safely and securely, but expeditiously and immediately, frankly, in order to just enable more activity here in the United States so that companies don't lose interest, frankly, in doing business, in trying to do business here in the United States. We have dozens of companies that have been working, for example, to get their type certificate with the FAA for the last 5 years or longer. And only one company has been successful. It took them 4 years and 4 months to do so. That was one of our clients, Matternet. And we haven't seen any approval since then. And for, you know how quickly this technology develops, right? Like if the technology is developing every 6 months, you have a new model of drone, then how does a 4 year long type certification process where you essentially have to freeze the technology in place make sense for anyone, right? So this is a challenge that we've been working on. It's certainly something that, you know, the White House AAM summit was held at, you know, for exactly this reason, to try to promote this technology and moving the rulemakings forward. But it's a challenge.
You mentioned like the Blue UAS program at DOD, which we've been very familiar with. And I think I'm going to probably get the numbers wrong, but you'll probably remember. And I, but like DJI, the Chinese drone manufacturer, has, I want to say, well more than half the market share, I think, globally for drones in a certain class. We've certainly been getting, you know, questions from industry about, well, how does that affect us back here in the United States, right? Like, on the one hand, we know that, you know, government agencies are not able to use DJI drones. There's been bans on that. But say I'm a government contractor, I'm someone else who, you know, does work for the U.S. government. What is my relationship with DJI? Can I not buy them? You know, what, am I prohibited from using parts and components? You know, we see all sort of, this is part of sort of the like bans on Chinese equipment, bans on Chinese components. All that's kind of gone along in other technology sectors that Tim and I are covering, but I'd like to spend a few minutes just talking about that in the drone space, right? Sort of what are the prohibitions here? Because unfortunately, in a lot of technology sectors, this is what companies in the US have to deal with.
Well, and I would also just add, it's not only the federal government who's imposed this ban, but we're also seeing certain states like Florida, for example. The state of Florida just recently passed legislation that said that state and local government agencies are only allowed to use drone technology that is on the blue list, which this blue list is the, you know, gold star, you're allowed to use it technology. I think it's interesting. And Mike, you're certainly an expert on this. And, you know, we work with clients on this together all the time. I think this is my understanding of how it all works. But in order to get onto the blue, you know, we get companies coming to us all the time. Well, how do we get onto this blue list? Well, in order to get onto the blue list, there has to be a demand from DOD to use your technology. And then once, you know, there's a demand from Army, Navy, whoever it is, to use your technology, then they will consider it to be, you know, added to this blue list. Now the blue list, though, is being used for all different kinds of purposes that it wasn't actually designed for. And that's actually become like a big issue in the community where people are saying, well, only if you're on the blue list, but then the blue list was designed for something very in particular that is good for the military. But if for other use cases, it might be different types of technologies that are more important. So there's a lot of thought about how to handle that on the commercial side. You know, I can say that this is a bipartisan issue on the Hill. So it's not something that we see Republicans and Democrats necessarily disagreeing on. So I don't really see the issue going away. It's something that industry should be thinking about. You know, there's certainly lots of questions about it, but that is one effort by the federal government around security that certainly affects the commercial space.
Yeah, the limited information, I guess, is pretty challenging. I think we just want to note that particularly for the listeners here, that as you said, like we'll take a cybersecurity example, which is something we'll talk about in this show another time. But like, if I have to meet FedRAMP for cloud computing, right, the standards are known in public. And if I need to go through a process to get accredited, if you will, by a government customer, I know what I have to meet, right? There's essentially a list of criteria and you have to go down. Problem that we've seen with industry is that for the Blue UAS program, it's essentially sort of DOD will do a vetting process, but what they're vetting you against is potentially a case-by-case basis, and then they say you're good to go. I would also note that I think, if I recall back when DOD first had their memo, this is a couple of years ago, I think even before maybe it was with the statute, about they weren't going to use Chinese drones. There's something out there publicly, I think, from the DOD that says, but SOCOM can on their own sort of decide they're going to use drones based on their own process, Special Operations Command. And that kind of predates the Blue UAS program and unfortunately kind of goes to a thing we've often seen where, well, you know, the Special Operations Command sometimes based on their mission could kind of do their own thing, mm-hmm. which is good for them, but it also creates more uncertainty for industry about, well, again, for them, maybe whatever they're vetting against, maybe that should be publicly disclosed. But is there something for like the general components of DOD or sort of in other areas that are not for special operations where you can just make the standard, if you will, available so that companies can know, okay, I got to come in and meet these criteria. It could be, again, cybersecurity is a good example. We know that's one thing that they're testing it against, but it's not public. So if I'm a company and I'm told I have to do something to meet certain US government cybersecurity standards or frankly Buy American domestic content type standards, then I know what they are and I'll structure my product that way. Here, we don't really have that answer. And so, again, as you said, I think it's a bipartisan issue on the behalf of industry. I think we would encourage the government to do what they can to make that public. or again, like we see, again, the cybersecurity standard, I keep going back to that, like codify it somewhere, right? Like codify that, like, this is the regulation, right, for Blue UAS that tells you the standards, same way I have to meet standards for other regulatory agencies. But that's my pitch for the DOD community, is that we have this uncertainty and no one will actually put the standard out there so you know what to meet.
Absolutely. More transparency is always welcome.
So before we wrap up, you know, just preview of next year, I guess FAA reauthorization looks like a lot of these issues are going to be tied up in that. When do you expect that process to kick off? And have you heard anything sort of about the new lineup in the House, given the results of the election, or is that still TBD?
So certainly there's been already a lot of action. I believe that policy proposals to the Hill on FAA reauth were due like last June or so. I mean, obviously it's a rolling basis, but my understanding is, you know, the thought is there may even be a whole separate title. Tons of content on UAS and AAM, Advanced Air Mobility, which we haven't really talked about. That's kind of another part of our practice. You know, we've talked a lot about drone technology from on the unmanned side, but there's also passenger carrying automated vehicles like you know, think of the Jetsons, you know, flying automated air taxis, which is incredibly exciting. And we're seeing that technology move very quickly forward as well on the industry side. And so there's going to be a lot of attention paid there. And I think, you know, I testified at the Senate Commerce Committee in September. That was the first hearing that the Senate Commerce Committee had on the FAA reauthorization. So those hearings have already kicked off. Obviously, we're in kind of a lame duck session right now, or like a transition period before the new Congress. We'll have to see how things go. But like I said, you know, on this topic, it's been pretty bipartisan. It's not a strongly Democratic or strongly Republican issue. It's very bipartisan. You know, during the hearing, I got questions from both sides of the aisle that were very similarly supportive of moving this technology forward, and also supportive of issues around drone security. You know, like I said, some of the questions that have been raised with regard to drone security will get a lot more attention over the next year. Lots to look forward to. I think 2023 is going to be an incredibly busy year. So, you know, let's get some sleep over the holidays and get excited.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Lisa. This was great. Mike, any last thoughts?
No, I just want to say, Lisa, thanks for joining us. And as you said, there'll be a lot in 2023. And I think maybe even want to come back and look at the air mobility as another topic we can talk about, even just that piece. So thank you for joining us.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Tim. Great to be with you all.
Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Hogan Lovells National Security Podcast. To learn more about top 10 global law firm Hogan Lovells with more than 50 offices worldwide, please visit HoganLovells.com.